Welcome on to the day before the season starts edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. All of the season previews are done. Go back and listen to those immediately if the season hasn't started yet when you're listening to these, because obviously they're completely worthless the moment the season tips off. But you should also listen to this episode because joining me for the first time in a long time, a man that I missed greatly while I was doing the season previews, Daniel LaRue. What's up, man?
It's nice to be on. I mean, it's been a while, and it's crazy because we've also seen each other since we last recorded.
Yeah, it's amazing how that works, like actually seeing people in real life.
I don't do much of that, so.
All right, well, I should probably abandon the levity for a moment to talk about Flip Saunders passing away at age 60 on Sunday, which is certainly tragic for the Timberwolves organization, and really the outpouring of support shows how much it's affected pretty much everyone who knew him. And you and I just had brief surface-level conversations with him, in both of which he was very nice to two completely unknown NBA writers at the time. And so I don't really feel qualified to opine that much on what kind of man he was, but I think just talking about some of the highlights of his career is something that's important as well. And I think he really was one of the best coaches in the NBA through pretty much the entire decade of the 2000s.
Yeah, and also what I like to think about with him is the role that he played in shepherding some of the important players in the league, especially Kevin Garnett, into our consciousness. And you can see that also in the outpouring of support, is the effect that he had on players who are still affecting the league.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back at some of the seasons that he had, you know, KG was a great player, but he took a team that had KG, Sam Cassell, and Latrell Sprewell, and Wally Szczerbiak as its main players to the number one seed in the West, and in 2004, the year KG won MVP, and you could argue that they might have made the finals that year had it not been for Cassell basically getting injured and missing a lot of that series with the Lakers, and then who knows what would have happened had they played the Pistons in that final. So that was a run of bad luck, but I think you would have to argue that given the talent on hand, which wasn't a ton other than KG, who was probably the best player in the league for a 2 or 3 year stretch overall there, he overachieved, I think, with a lot of those Wolves teams in the middle part of that decade.
Yeah, you had that, and then also his stretch with the Pistons, I think, was notable, and also with the Wizards. And so he touched a fascinating cross-section of the league to me, and how he also, as an executive and with a coach with the Timberwolves again, and so he had an imprint other places, and you know, was involved in the acquisition, the major trade that they had with the fifth pick that got them Mike Miller. And I've been thinking a lot about it, not only with the personal interaction, but just to have somebody who not only had that impact in the league, but was still so heavily involved at the time. It's crushing for the league, and especially for the Timberwolves, considering his role.
Yeah, another great team of his was that 05-06 Pistons team.
Yeah.
I mean, he, after Minnesota predictably declined with Cassell and Sprewell pretty much being done as like high level players the year after they made it to the conference finals, and he ended up getting fired. And then the next year, after the Pistons had made the finals, they Larry Brown moved on, and then they basically had their pick of the litter of pretty much any coach who was available, and they picked Flip that year, and it looked like a great decision because he kind of took the reins off the offense a little bit. They played a little bit more zone as he was want to do as well. That was another one of the big strategic innovations that he did a lot of, especially with KG playing at the top of his zone in Minnesota once the illegal defense rules were loosened up. And I think they're 64-18 in that 06 season. They made three straight conference finals under Flip. And even that 08 Pistons team was a team that was a very underrated and ended up losing to the Celtics in six. But that was throughout the course of that season was considered the best team or the second best team in the NBA to that 66 win Celtics team. I think they won 59 games that year. And then even, you know, he made it into the Eastern Conference Finals in 07 as well, and only was derailed from getting to the finals that year by just that ridiculous LeBron performance when he had 25 straight points and 29 out of 30 points in that game five. So really, he coached some very underrated teams and didn't have quite as much success, obviously, after leaving Detroit. But, you know, I think that it's really important to remember that he was a really good coach. I mean, I think he was also, like, in the top 10 in wins. Is that right? Did I see that in the last couple of days?
You might have. I haven't seen that, but that wouldn't surprise me, considering the duration of time that he spent in the league and on those, especially the successful Pistons teams, where they were just competitive every single year.
All right. So I guess we should probably move on to some news at this point. Probably the biggest thing that's happened since we last talked was Tristan Thompson actually signing on Thursday. 5 for $82, identical money to what Draymond Green got. What's your reaction?
I feel like this is where it was always going to end up. I think that there was that stretch right after he didn't accept the qualifying offer when you kind of had that game theory idea of will the Cavs really play hardball here. But at the same time, you always knew that Rich Paul was his agent, the connection with LeBron, and something in the 580 stratosphere always seemed about right.
Yeah, I had a podcast, the Cavs preview, with Chris Haynes when we were right in the meat of that period after they did not accept the qualifying offer and let it expire. And I know some people like Dan Feldman were saying that, you know, the Cavs should play hardball and pull the offer. Larry Kuhn actually reported at one point that he was told that the offer had been pulled, but that obviously apparently was not the case. And the Cavs, whether it was because they couldn't alienate LeBron, because they needed Thompson, because it just wasn't worth it to pull the offer and try to really squeeze him, they decided to just kick in another $2 million. And I mean, this is what's most notable about this to me is they offered him 5 for $80 on the first day of free agency, basically, and they were about to get there. And then supposedly once Draymond Green signed his for a little bit more than Thompson, and of course Draymond Green supposedly the impetus to increase the amount that he got was because of the reported Thompson deal, which then didn't actually turn out to be real. So it makes sense that they actually ended up signing for the same amount. It seems like much ado over nothing to get an extra $2 million over 5 years, though.
I think in a lot of ways that was probably a face-saving move because you're sitting there, and obviously the Cavs.
Yeah, I think it was just a sop to Rich Paul. I think that's ultimately what it was, just to allow him to say, all right, we got more, and now we can go in. So, I mean, in some ways, the fact that that offer got publicized so early on might have even been bad for the negotiations.
It probably was, but it might have helped Thompson eventually because then they could point to that number and say, come on now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so Draymond is underpaid compared to Thompson. I think we can both agree.
No, Tristan Thompson is just as good as Draymond Green.
So another interesting note, Andre Drummond is reported that he will not sign a contract extension with the Pistons. That apparently is by design because they can get another basically $12.8 million in cap room next summer by retaining his cap hold, which I think is it's like in the $8 million somewhere, like $8.2 million, I think, and then his max would be $21 million, might even be more than that if the cap goes up more than the $89 million that we're anticipating. So it sounds like he is totally on board with this plan. There are some reports that Arne Tellem was working on him because Tellem is now working for the Pistons to accept that. And I ultimately don't think there's a ton of risk here for the Pistons, because they can always give him a max qualifying offer if he needs to. And, we can also note that this is exactly what we predicted would happen on our mock extension podcast.
It was, and it was hilarious because you guys agreed to that. And then I kind of came in as what I thought was the reality check of like, come on, the Pistons can't you let this happen just because the way that it works, you know, it doesn't usually happen, but if both sides are confident that they can, most importantly to me, that the Pistons can actually use that money. With Kawhi, there was an understanding that the Spurs would do something with it. The Pistons have had trouble finding people to take their money at points, so it's nice. I'm hopeful that it will lead to them getting another piece, but at the same time, it would be a little bit weird if it ended up yielding very little fruit.
Yeah, so they could have now up to about $28 million in cap room, depending on what happens with Ersan Ilyasova. He's only $400,000 guaranteed out of his $8.4 million for next year, so they could move on from him and get max space. You know, who knows who they're going to use it on, because everybody's going to have max space, it seems like. But yeah, I think the only interesting thing that'll remain to be seen is whether he ends up getting an ETO on that fifth year or not, mm-hmm. because maybe that's sort of what they gave him to incite him to do this. So that'll be interesting to watch, but I think Tom Gore has basically said he's a max player at the end of the year. So I would expect him to re-sign there under all but the weirdest circumstances.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it.
All right, another interesting one for cap dorks. J.P. Tokoto made some news as the 58th pick. It was reported that he originally was going to go play overseas. He then forced the Sixers to sign him to the required tender, which is a one-year minimum, non-guaranteed contract. Every team has to offer a draft pick that to retain their rights, and he said, hey, I want to come into camp, give me this. So they gave it to him, and then he didn't make the team, and now he's released. So some people might say that's a good thing. At least now he's out there without anybody having his draft rights. But on the other hand, now he doesn't really have that sort of mirage of still being an NBA draft pick. He's now not made the Sixers, which is the worst team in the league, although they may have a little bit more depth than some teams do on the very back end. So I don't know. Any thoughts on that? Did he gamble and lose? Was that the right decision? What do you think?
I think it was the right decision because while there is a chance that teams like to bring back their own guys, the Sixers have been so pragmatic recently that you kind of feel like they wouldn't give him a necessary advantage in that way, especially because it was non-guaranteed. So now he's free to pursue things as he wants to do it. I think it's a good move for him. I think that more players in that realm should do it just to get their a clean slate. I don't think that the stain of not making a team really lasts too long, especially if he's going to go overseas. You can build your brand that way. There are lots of players who've washed out of the NBA in various capacities who come back as kind of a pseudo international player.
Yeah, Arslan Kazemi was another guy too who the Sixers basically ended up releasing him so he could sign with Atlanta. He then did not make that team, and I think now he's going to be playing in the D League for the Austin Spurs. But yeah, so that, and Pierre Jackson also got released by the Sixers, which is kind of too bad. But for people who just say that Sam Hinkie is, you know, so bloodless and unfeeling, he basically gave Pierre Jackson a guaranteed year this year after he tore his Achilles, and now he's ended up cutting him because he's not going to make the team. But you know, he didn't have to do that. He tore his Achilles playing for the Sixers team last year, and Sam basically, you know, it's looking like kind of just gave him a gift on the hope that he could come back, but he's not going to be able to make the team now, unfortunately.
And they also spent money trying to develop and procure for Furkan Aldemir, and they ended up cutting bait on him as well.
Yeah, I think they're actually giving up like $2 million.
2.8, I think.
On him. Yeah, and there were the reports from my current employer, The Cauldron, about a really long article a couple weeks ago about what's going on in Philly. And one of the sort of notes was, hey, this strategy is going stale. Some of the minority owners are getting a little upset. And this basically cutting a guy who's due $2 million might be another example of that. But that's part of the plan with Hinkie. You're counting on math, essentially. And they're still going to be below the salary floor. And so if you have a $2 million sunk cost, the guy wasn't going to work out. That's what they paid to get him in. They got to look at him. It didn't work. So let him go.
Yeah. In a way, it's a spiritual analog to what Dallas did. Dallas spent money on some players that they ended up not keeping, but that allowed them to get certain players into camp and allowed them to get better options. And so you would think that it didn't cost them much in the end, but it helped them get the best team. And for the Sixers, it's not only the best team this year, but long term. And they're going to be dealing with an issue in the very near term about they have so many injuries in terms of roster spots, I think that they've done a nice job. Christian Wood made their team. I was a big supporter of him going into the draft. I really like him, and we'll see what they do, but they'll get a 16th spot probably for a short term, and that'll help them too.
Yeah, Wood, who was reported, had some really terrible interviews.
Yep.
And that's why he slid completely out of the draft, but he's got so much talent. I still think somebody should have taken a chance on him, and he obviously is impressed enough in Philly to make the roster over some guys that they had bigger investments in. All right, some quick hitters here on injuries. P.J. Hairston is likely to start the opener. I think that's probably just because Jeremy Lamb is struggling with an ankle injury for Charlotte. But P.J. Hairston is not a great NBA player. Charlotte really thin on the wing beyond Nicola Batum. So that's going to be something to watch. I talked a lot about that when I had Spencer Percy on for the Charlotte preview. If you want to hear some more of my thoughts on their situation, you can go back and listen to that. For Dallas, surprisingly enough, Wes Matthews actually looks like he's going to play. He played a couple minutes in the preseason finale against the Bulls and looked okay, hit a three-pointer. Chandler Parsons will not be playing in the opener, however, and his timeline still remains a little bit nebulous. Another big one, though, that I wanted to get your thoughts on, Tyreek Evans has now had his third knee surgery, I think, in the last 2 years. This is another scope. He's out 6 to 8 weeks, which is, some would say, a little bit longer than the normal arthroscopic surgery. I think that's actually about right. It sounds like it's another kind of meniscus trim debridement type of thing. But they couldn't really afford to lose him with Jrue Holiday already on a minutes limit.
Their big issue is creation, you know, getting guys who can create shots for themselves and others. And Jrue Holiday is even not, that's not his personal strength. He's more of a defender and then a creator. And so now they do have players. I mean, Eric Gordon is definitely a talented basketball player, but that isn't his strength. So they're going to be asking Anthony Davis to do some different things. I'm excited to see how it looks. I'm of course disappointed because this makes New Orleans a weaker team. And also it affects their ability to make the playoffs because, you know, if you're going to have to struggle more for these early games, that just makes it harder later in the year.
Yeah. I think their biggest problem is just not having enough NBA players right now, frankly, of guys who are not just kind of replacement level, and missing Evans, who really kept them afloat without Holiday last year, I think is going to be a problem. You're right that they're just are not going to have anybody who looks like they can get to the basket.
And the bottom of their bench is just shaky.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. A couple other minor ones here. Jarrett Jack looking like he is doubtful for the season opener. It's going to be Donald Sloan and Shane Larkin starting at point guard. Jack has a hamstring injury. It was also reported by the Indy Star that Monte Ellis actually had a minor left knee surgery during the offseason. That just came out now. I don't know why that wasn't something that was announced by the team until now. But and I guess it wasn't even announced by the team now, but he looks fine. I don't think that's anything to worry about. And then Aaron Aflalo said over the weekend that his hamstring strain, he could be as much as 2 weeks to come back. So it is Sasha Vujicic time at the two guard for the New York Knicks to start the season, it looks like.
And all three of these, along with Tyreek, are all teams that don't have guard depth. And it's kind of sad and at the same point unsurprising with most of these, that it's these teams that don't have depth in the first place but added pieces that are the ones that are struggling the most to get field a competitive roster.
Yeah, and Sasha Vujicic, he may know the triangle. He may be good at annoying people, but he also has been out of the NBA for 4 years for a reason.
Yeah.
And
the Knicks, it's
so
not
I
like
don't
the Knicks have a murderer's
well.
Row at point guard either.
Yeah, and I mean, that defensive backcourt of Vujicic and Calderon is, and then Carmelo at the three, Porzingis at the four, is probably he's starting at the four, that's going to be a disaster. I mean, Lopez is really going to be their only guy in that starting lineup who can guard anyone. And while Aflalo is no great shakes, I mean, he's at least, you know, a decent NBA player, and, you know, they are running short of those. So it's not a great start for the Knicks. All right, you want to do a little season preview thoughts here?
Sure.
All right, so I think what we'll do here is we'll go through our picks for some of the major awards, then do our picks for the top eight seeds in each conference, and then maybe a couple more kind of more off-the-wall type of predictions and just sort of see where we go and any other just kind of general thoughts that we end up having. All right, let's start with MVP. Who's your MVP? When I do mine, I'm going to go with the player I think is actually the best player in the league, who's going to add the most to his team's bottom line and deserves it. But you know, you may find it more interesting to just pick who you think will win it. But I think it's more instructive to just pick who I think is the best guy instead of trying to predict, you know, what the beat writer and you know, some NBA backwater thinks you know, after having seen a guy twice all year.
I think that that's a more fun way to do it. I actually haven't done that at all, so I'm going to follow the same rubric. And for MVP, I'm going to go with Stephen Curry. I think that he is the linchpin of that offense, and I think that that is a very important part of this. I think Durant and Davis and LeBron and a series of other players will be close, but I think he will be deserving of most valuable player even if he doesn't win it, which I don't think he will.
Interesting. So you think he's going to be the best player in the league this year?
I think he's going to be the most valuable player in the league.
Okay, so is the implication there that there'll be some guys who are better but just don't play as much?
Anthony Davis and Kevin Durant, yeah.
All right, so you're thinking AD will miss his typical 10 yep. games a year, and that's why Curry will just have more overall value.
Correct.
I can see that standpoint. I think, as an aside, just about a 0% chance Curry actually wins the
exactly.
year.
Agreed.
Because even if they win 65 games again this year, it's going to be kind of voter fatigue. I think he could very easily have a better season on a per-play basis this year, especially with how unbelievable he's looked in the preseason. But, yeah, I'm going to go with KD. I think that his 2014 was way better than what anyone did in 2015. I haven't heard anything medically to indicate, you know, he may re-injure himself, but until such time as he does, I don't think it's something that's going to be nagging his performance. He looks like every bit of the player that he was 2 years ago in the preseason. He's got a lot to prove. It's a huge season. He's got a new coach who I think, and maybe some better offensive talent around him, at least, if not defensive talent, than they've had in the past. So I will go with him. I think he's just going to be the best player in the league by a decent margin. Number two would probably be Curry. I'd agree with you that maybe AD might end up a little bit better than him on a per-play basis, but might miss some games. But it's a tough call between Curry and AD. And then I would have LeBron, Harden, and Westbrook kind of in the next tier after those guys.
Yeah, I think that's
maybe Blake Griffin will get into that area as well, but I kind of see him as more saving it for the playoffs. But we shouldn't discount completely that Blake Griffin through 12 games of last year's playoffs was the best player in the playoffs. So we should remember that and give that some respect to them.
Absolutely. And I think there are a lot of guys who I think will be kind of in that conversation of people who think that they should be in the conversation, like Kawhi Leonard, but I don't think that he'll get any consideration.
Yeah, he's just not good enough at scoring
yeah.
for me to be in that absolute top echelon. Defensive player of the year.
I think Rudy Gobert is going to be the most deserving. He was the best rim protector in the league last year per Nylon Calculus's measure. I would agree with that from my anecdotal heavy watching of the Jazz. I think they're going to be a great defensive team this year. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you is, in terms of most deserving with this award, do you see it as most outstanding defender, most valuable, or do you not make a distinction?
I mean, what's even the difference between those two things? Outstanding is more on a per-play basis, and most valuable is over the course of the entire year.
Well,
is that
you're drawing there? For me, most valuable is like the greater overall impact. So, like, let's say for me, Andrew Bogut played less minutes, but he was more effective in the minutes he played. Like, I don't know. It's hard to say. I was just interested in your thought process.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I think of it is just, all right, I got one player to start a good NBA defense, who's it going to be?
Okay.
That's kind of the way I think, you know, for this upcoming season or the season just passed, at the end of the year, you know, if we consider games played as well, who is the guy that I want to start my awesome defense with? And I think I will go with AD on that. I think especially because I think he's going to make some strides as a rim protector this year with being around the basket a little bit more. In a more conservative system under Darren Erman, where they're going to keep the bigs back. But I also think that his ability to switch out is basically something that's going to be unparalleled in the league. And so with that type of versatility and basically being able to be a center in all possible defensive respects, except maybe against the largest post-up behemoths, and I think he's going to get a lot of time at center as well this year, I think it's probably going to be him, and I think that New Orleans can take a step forward defensively. I think the offense might decline because of the injuries, but defensively that they're going to get better and that he can be an enormous part of that. So I think he'll probably end up being there, but that is admittedly taking a little bit of a leap because, you know, they were 22nd in defense last year, despite his good on-off metrics. Who are some of, like, the dark horse candidates you would look at besides Gobert and AD? Those two seem like kind of the largest ones, but, you know, Gobert may be toiling in a little bit too much anonymity in Utah.
Dwight Howard? I think this is the Dwight Howard, his mojo reclamation year, both in terms of the way the press talks about him and also...
I think he's not going to play enough.
That could be. Let's see, who else?
Especially with just the... Yeah, I agree with you that maybe this would be, oh, now he's doing the little things, he's a winner, blah, blah, blah.
Ibaka, if the Thunder defense
yeah,
is
I mean,
good.
Kawhi won it last year.
Yeah.
Draymond Green was second last year. There's no reason to think that those guys are going to have a drop-off, I suppose.
You and I both said that if the Lakers are competent on defense, that Hibbert deserves a lot of that credit, but I don't think they will be.
Yeah, their on-off numbers with him in the preseason were pretty terrible. They were kind of at a bottom five rate even when he was out there. I think they're over 110 points per 100 allowed in the preseason per NBA.com when he was on the floor.
And then the other two guys I'd mentioned that are going to be those trendy, I don't want to comment on the people who will bring up these cases, but would be DeAndre Jordan and Hassan Whiteside for almost the same reasons.
Yeah, Whiteside, maybe. I mean, if he can keep his head screwed on straight and Miami has a really good defensive performance, I think the lion's share of the credit for that will end up having to go to him. I also don't think he's going to play his enough minutes. He gets into foul trouble all the time. He gets injured a lot. You know, I think they're going to have a lot of, get suspended. Like, the coaches don't trust him. There's going to be a lot of times, maybe offensively, when they're going to want to have McRoberts on the floor instead of him. So I don't see him playing 30 minutes a game this year, and so it'll be tough that way. You know, it's a very interesting thing, and this is going to get to another one of my predictions. One player of, like, those 10 that we named are in the East.
You're right.
Like, the East is... what is going to be a good defense in the East? We can get to that, but that's something that I was sort of thinking about in trying to come up with these predictions. All right, Rookie of the Year.
Karl-Anthony Towns, so he'll be the best rookie.
Had a 23 PER in the preseason, 600 true shooting percentage, not shooting any threes yet, and I doubt that he will at all this year. I talked about that on the Minnesota preview that I did with Zach Harper. If you want some more on my thoughts on Towns and what the Wolves are going to look like this year, plug. And, yeah, I think he's just going to be the best. I think Okafor probably will win it. We talked about that in our little Blog Talk Radio roundtable. Actually, we're just regurgitating everything that we've talked about already. There's no point in even listening to this podcast. But, yeah, I think Okafor is just going to, shoot like 45% or something, but he's just going to have enough raw production. The only thing that could eat into that is I think the Sixers aren't going to play him that many minutes. I think they're trying to teach him how to play hard, and they've been playing him in shorter stints. So, but, I mean, he had his last game of the preseason, he was 6 out of 16. For like 14 points or something. I think he's going to have a lot of nights like that because I don't think he's going to get fouled that much either, and he's not going to necessarily hit his free throws at a great rate.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. Anything? I don't really think there's much else to say with Rookie of the Year, do you?
Yeah, Moutier is one who's been bandied about. I just don't think he's going to shoot efficiently enough. I think he is nearly a lock to have a true shooting percentage below 50%, especially with his free throw shooting not being that great. I think he's probably going to shoot under 40% from the field, so it's going to be hard. I think he's going to look real good and we'll be excited about his future, but I don't think, maybe if the Nuggets really, really destroy preseason expectations. Stanley Johnson is another one. I don't think he's, although he's not going to be starting, which is kind of too bad. It sounds like it's to be Marcus Morris. So that's another guy I could point to maybe if the Pistons were to make the playoffs, but I doubt he's going to have kind of the counting stats to get you there.
Okay, you want to do first-team All-NBA?
Yeah, mine is pretty basic, not too controversial, I don't think. Curry, Harden, KD, LeBron, Anthony Davis. Although I guess saying Anthony Davis is a center, but I mean, I think he's definitely going to close games at center, and with how few minutes Oshik plays, I guess Ajinso will get in there too, and maybe he'll play some minutes with Ajinso, but it wouldn't surprise me if he plays 40-50% of his minutes at center this year, if not more, depending on those center's health issues.
And considering that I think the guy who would be most likely to get the center spot if they count Davis as a forward is DeMarcus Cousins, I think the writers will be creative in their accounting to try to make that happen.
Yeah, again, this is my who will deserve it pick.
Yeah.
More than it than my, but yeah, I think he is going to be a lot better than Cousins will be, and probably you'll want to find a way to get him in there because LeBron. I mean, I think he's not going to play that many minutes. That's why I didn't really include him that much in the MVP because I don't think he's going to play as many minutes. And also, just you know, he's turning 31 this year, and I'm seeing some signs of slippage with him. He's still going to be great. Don't get me wrong, and he'll probably be better in the playoffs than during the regular season. But I think this is the year that he kind of falls out of the absolute top tier of guys, although his reputation may still dictate that it's he'll be a little higher, but that's at least what I think I'm going to be thinking of him at the end of the year.
Yeah, so if you were to count Davis as a forward, do you think you'd have Cousins as the center, or would you have Marc Gasol or someone else?
Oh, Cousins. I think Gasol, at his age, is, and having had a career year last year, is going to take a step back. I know that in Memphis, they think of him as last year being sustainable because he came in such better shape, and this year could be a continuation of that. But, you know, 30-year-old players who have the best year of their career don't improve the next year when they're 31. That's just not how it works.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair.
Did you have the same guys as me?
I did. I actually put Davis at forward and Cousins at center. But that's basically because I didn't.
You leave off LeBron.
Yeah,
or
I left
Katie?
Off LeBron in terms of deserving. I think LeBron will get. I think LeBron's going to win the MVP. So it's not like I'm talking about that in terms of what will actually happen with voting. But I like the endeavor of picking on deserving. And this year, more than most, I think that there is going to be a difference between those.
Who is your toughest omission other than LeBron? For me, it was
Westbrook. I mean, because Westbrook Harden is tough for me because I think a lot of that is situation dependent. I think if you put Russ in not on a team with Kevin Durant, he would be doing like what he did last year, where he was just an absolute monster.
Yeah, that's quite true. But my thinking was, KD missed a bunch of time last year. And Russ, to me, still was only kind of like my fifth best player in the league last year. So, I mean, I think he's probably a good pick for number six. Are you thinking that Chris Paul is going to take a little bit of a step back and not be in this discussion?
I think this is the year. I hate saying that. I love Chris Paul. I've been a fan of his since Wake Forest. And when you cross 30 as a point guard, especially when you're a smaller point guard, I just start to think that it's going to happen. It's just the way I am.
Yeah, Blake Griffin might be the other guy that you might look at as potentially getting into that area. All right, give me your top eight for the West. I have a feeling we're going to be pretty close on the West.
Yeah, I think we'll be pretty close. There were a couple of them that there are teams that I like, and I just couldn't put them over other teams. But one is the Warriors, two, Houston, three, the Thunder, four, the Spurs. And this is regular season record, not team quality.
Right, right.
Five, the Clippers. Six, the Grizzlies. Seven, the Pelicans. Eight, Jazz.
Yeah, so we have an identical bottom four. Clippers, Memphis, New Orleans, Utah. I might have picked New Orleans to challenge for the sixth seed against Memphis. But with all these injuries, it's really hard to do that. So really, I think where we disagree, I have Houston four, and you have them two. So you think, what is your rationale for why Houston is going to be second best in the West?
I think they're going to be a very good regular season team. They have the talent now to have capable offensive creators on the floor all the time. And they played, you know, they ended up the two seed in the West last year, and Dwight played 41 games. I think that they're deeper now. I think that they're better. And also, I think that the Spurs aren't going to care. I think that the Spurs aren't going to be gunning for the two seed, and the Rockets might. And with Oklahoma City, the difference between the two of those is my personal feeling is that when Oklahoma City is missing any one of their top three, any one of them, I think that they're in trouble, you know, for that stretch of time, whether it's two games or 20. And I think that Houston is a little bit more resilient, maybe not with Harden, but with Dwight and with Ty Lawson, obviously, because they played without him last year because they didn't have him.
Yeah, the reason I see Houston as number four instead of number two, I definitely understand your thinking there, but I don't see them as either a top five offense or defense this year.
I can see that.
You know, I think in the backcourt, they're not quite good enough to get there defensively. I still worry about Dwight a lot from a health standpoint, and I think it's going to be hard for them to have maybe even a top 10 defense if Dwight misses significant time. They got pretty lucky defensively last year. And then offensively, I just don't think they quite have enough shooting, especially at the four position. If they had like a real legitimate stretch four that I really believed in on this team, then I think you could look at this team as being like an absolute offensive juggernaut. I see them kind of being, you know, seventh or eighth offensively, seventh or eighth defensively. That's kind of where I see them this year. And I think the Spurs, when you look at how they closed last season and now just the number of quality players that they have, I think they're going to be pretty darn good. And I think OKC is just going to be a monster during the regular season this year. The only downside I see for them is that the kind of negative peripheral effects of Cantor and Waiters, whether it's Waiters offensively using up possessions inefficiently or Cantor dragging down the defense. But it sounds like despite the investment that they've made in those guys, that they're not necessarily going to have the absolute biggest roles. It's the only other thing I would say about Oklahoma City is that their starting lineup has two complete offensive zeros in Roberson and Adams. Adams is, I was really reminded in the preseason that he doesn't really do it that much offensively other than offensive rebound. He flubbed a bunch of pick and roll finishes in the games that I saw. He just doesn't shoot nearly as high of a percentage around the rim as he should given his physical abilities and role. So they might need to make a little bit of a change there because you're basically committing to starting those two guys. And I think Adams should be in the starting lineup. I think he's really important to their defense. But maybe someone like Morrow or Singler would be better in the starting lineup than Robertson, who is awesome defensively. I will give him that. And that is going to be a really good defensive starting lineup for Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to see where not only where their starting lineup starts, but where it finishes. Are they going to kind of balance these competing ideas? Or are they going to try to reconcile it, go one way with maybe with the two guard and one way with the center? But they have so much talent that I can totally see people being really optimistic on them. They're such a good team when they have everything together.
All right, of the teams that you did not list in the playoffs. I mean, I think we both see Sacramento and Phoenix as kind of being in the mix for the eighth seed. And I don't necessarily expect that the eighth seed is going to require 45 or more wins this year the way it has in past years in the West. Outside of Sacramento and Phoenix, who are the most likely... And I guess we could throw Dallas in there too, but of Minnesota, Portland, Denver, and the Lakers, which of those teams is most likely to surprise and exceed 35 wins?
I'd say Minnesota just because I think they have the most talent, and I can see a pathway for them to be decent on both ends because what makes them different than a team like Denver is that they could play guys that are more established if they want to, more minutes. Ricky Rubio is an NBA point guard. Kevin Garnett is only going to play like 20 minutes a game. We both like Karl Anthony Towns. I see that, and I think that the other team would be Portland, but I just don't see how they beat people reliably enough to get to, let's say, 38 wins.
Yeah, I think most of the statistical analysis likes Portland the best out of those teams. I tend to agree with that because I think that they could potentially be a top 10 offense. With the guys that they have, with Lillard, his shooting, I think, other than Steph Curry, he's the guy at the point guard position that really bends the defense. You just can't let him get a three-point shot off. You can't go under on him in the pick and roll. I think he's going to have some good pick and roll partners to work with. And I could see them maybe, if everything goes right, getting into the top 10 in offense. CJ McCollum could have a really good year. Now, I think they're going to be horrendous defensively. I think there's no way that they're out of the bottom 10 in defense. But I think that they probably look like the team where it can all come together the most for me. Minnesota, I don't see it with them because I think that the system, they have a lot of talent, I agree with you, but I think the system that they're playing is not really going to work. They're going to have no spacing. They're starting Levine, so I think that that is indicative of the type of development that they want to do. It looks like Tayshaun Prince is going to get a lot of minutes for this team as well, which is a little worrisome because since he can't shoot at all, I think that this team is just not going to have the shooting or the offensive intelligence to leverage the offensive talents of guys like Wiggins, Rubio, and especially Towns. So I think that they are going to be mired below 30 wins almost certainly for me.
Yeah, I think that all these teams are going to struggle. I just think that they're the most likely team for me to outperform that expectation for the reasons I said.
Yeah, I would for like that bottom four. My power rankings would be Portland, Denver, Minnesota, and then the Lakers.
Yeah,
and I might flip the Lakers and Minnesota. Actually, yeah, I'll put the Lakers ahead of Minnesota just because I think the Lakers are going to be trying, and Minnesota is going to be in mostly a developmental year. All right, should we do the East?
Well, let's. I want to talk a little bit about Dallas. They're a team that yes. I'm struggling with for the logic that I see major flaws in their team, in their talent, and everything else. But Rick Carlisle is a great coach. And so for me, what I think is the question that is going to pervade this team is, are they going to struggle enough where the pick protection comes into play?
Yeah, that's something I talked about a lot with Rob Mahoney. When I asked him that question, like, what percent chance do you think there is that they actually keep that pick? I think we both kind of settled in the 20% range. I would say even as low as 15, because if it were top 10 protected, I would be all about that, but I think they're going to be trying for too long, especially since it looks like Matthews is a little bit ahead of schedule. We don't know what's going to happen with Parsons, but they're just not going to be able to pull the plug early enough, and they still have Dirk, too. To get into that top seven really would take some doing, so unless they are just get off to a horrible start early on, I don't see them tanking, and even if they do, it's really hard to get into that top seven with some of the talent that they have. So, and they also have some free agents to be as well. Dirk, Chandler Parsons, maybe even if they want to retain someone like Deron Williams, that if they just tank it up, those guys aren't going to want to stick around either. So they also have that to worry about.
One thing I'll mention also is that when you're a team that's trying to recruit free agents next summer, which they will be, when you're falling into the top seven, you're not, unless you get lucky and win the lottery, you're not going far enough where you'll get a player that other guys want to play with. You know, you're not in a situation where you can say, hey, well, you get to play with D'Angelo Russell or Carl Towns. It's going to be, you know, somebody in that mix of, oh, they should be a good rotation player eventually. So you're not even getting that sales pitch of a truly elite player.
Yeah, and Rob made the point to me, too, that they may want to just get this obligation out of the way this year.
Because it has protection for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's top seven protected for, like, the next 4 years.
Yeah, until, like, 2020,
so,
I think.
And they may be, you know, frankly, I don't see a great path to relevance for this team right now, so they may be in that kind of same range these next few years. Maybe it's nice to get the pick out of the way, especially because this is a draft that people are not as high on, at least, you know, at this incredibly preliminary point, which it probably isn't even worth making those valuations, but that's what people seem to be thinking, so you got to consider that.
Sure. One other quick thing. Sacramento versus Phoenix. Which do you think ends the season with a better record?
I will say Phoenix, but we'll see what happens with Sacramento. I think that Sacramento has some pieces, and if they can come together right and be used correctly, that they could exceed that as well. And I think if they can play small a little bit more, play a little bit faster around Cousins, that doesn't seem like the way that they are going necessarily, but they could evolve into that depending on what happens with Cauley-Stein, who actually, George Call said, is probably going to start alongside Cousins, which would be interesting.
We get to test out our draft night argument.
and Cauley-Stein, I mean, he's looked good. Like, my thoughts on that wasn't that he's a bad player. I think he's going to be pretty good. It was just that I didn't like the fit that well with Cousins. But anyway, yeah, I think I don't feel strongly either way on that question.
Yeah, I was leaning, again, it's close, but I actually think that could matter because the assumption has to be that at least one team in the West is going to fall out, you know, like Oklahoma City did last year. And until this weekend, I was thinking Phoenix, but now I'm leaning Sacramento on the logic that they have a better singular player and assuming you think that he's actually going to play, which I think he will. I think he'll stay on the court better this year. And because I think that there's basically zero chance that Sacramento folds it in because they're going to a new arena, whereas Phoenix is always looking to deal. That's just the way they are. So I could see that, and also I'm not sold that this Phoenix, like, they're starting five. I just see it. There's a very real potential of it just not working.
Yeah, I can see that. The shooting is certainly a question, especially, I mean, whether it's Tucker or whether it's Warren in the starting lineup. All right, let's start with, just give me your top four in the East.
Okay, this is brutal. So I have
it's so brutal.
Cleveland 1, Atlanta 2, Chicago 3, Washington 4.
This is why I struggled with this so much. I think it is unlikely that Cleveland gets the number one seed just because of all the injuries they have. I think they're really going to miss Shumpert. Kyrie, nobody knows when he's going to be back. I think that they could definitely struggle defensively quite a bit without Shumpert, with Love coming back in. Mozgov's still struggling after his knee surgery, which he had back in July. LeBron has this back issue. He had an injection in his lower back. He's supposed to be ready to start the season, but he's also, they're going to be trying to play him a lot less minutes also. So I think with all that concern, J.R. Smith will probably take a step back this year at his age. It's just hard for me to see how they get to the number of wins that it's going to take. Now, I have no idea which of about six teams is going to be better than them. So from a mathematical standpoint, I would still be better off picking Cleveland just because they probably have a better individual chance at the number one seed than any other team. But I think that one of those teams is going to surpass them. I had no idea which one, so I decided, just kind of based on two factors. One, the way they played in the preseason, and two, the fact that I think they are the only East team that has a decent shot at a top five defense this year. The Washington Wizards are my choice for the number one seed.
Wow. That would be very cool.
And I just hope that Beal and Wall can take a step forward. I think Gortat is going to be awesome now with all the space on the floor. Jared Dudley at least is back. He's working his way into shape, but he'll enable them to play small the way they want to a little more. I still worry about the wing depth. Webster looks like he's out for a while. Allen Anderson had another surgery on his ankle, which is too bad. We don't know when he's going to be back, but yeah, I don't feel confident at all about that pick, by the way. So please don't give me too much shit about that on Twitter. I think there's just as easy of a chance it could be Chicago, even Toronto, Miami. So then my two is Cleveland. Three is Chicago. I don't think that Chicago, with this, the fact that Gasol and Mirotic are now going to be starting in the front court, I think their defense is just not going to be good enough. I think they're going to miss Dunleavy some. I don't see a way that this team is going to be a top 10 defensive team unless they're... I think Noah looks better, and Taj Gibson looks good in the preseason too after his ankle surgery, and maybe they can make up some of that difference because it looks like those guys are going to be playing together a lot on the second unit, and they should be able to really shut teams down with those two guys. But I would have felt a lot better about their defensive chances if they were mixing up Noah and Mirotic and Gibson and Gasol, but it doesn't look like that's what the strategy is going to be. And then with four, I add the Hawks. Any thoughts on what I said there with the Bulls or the Wizards?
I think that your logic is sound. One thing why I had Atlanta second is that they're a really well-coached team. And I think that I talked about this with Arturo Galletti when I was doing over-unders with him, my plug, that I think that what has shaped – I've been thinking too much about Atlanta that I think they're a flawed playoff team. But that doesn't really hurt them as much in the regular season. They have two strong point guards. They have depth most places. They have a really good coach. And so I think that puts them closer to where they were. I still think they're going to be worse, and they outperformed last year. But I think that they're, to me, the logical team to be that contender, just because it might be a hollow win total, but it could be, you know, in the 50 range. But what you said about Cleveland, I think all that's true, and they're just going to have the best record in the East with a low total. I think that that's one of the storylines of this year, is I think that the East is going to just not have that 55-60 win team. They're just going to have maybe a 52-53 win Cavs team having the best record.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I just think that from a statistical standpoint, one of those four or five teams below Cleveland is going to have everything go right. And that's happened pretty much every year since 2010. It was the Bulls in 2011, the Pacers in 2014, the Hawks in 2015. Like, one of these East teams kind of blows up that we don't really see coming. I think that's going to be someone I'm just at a bit of a loss to predict who it's going to be. So that's, I mean, a lot of people are really high on Chicago. Zach Lowe is saying he's going to pick them to get the number one seed. What do you think of Chicago so far?
I like a lot of what they're doing. I think that they're actually running an offense now that I enjoy watching. I'm so happy that they're starting Mirotić. But
yeah, all this talk of Rose pushing the ball up the floor really hard, that's everything that I was asking for in last year's playoffs. I'm really excited about that.
I'm thrilled with all that, but to me, to be the number one seed in a conference, you have to be more reliable on defense than they're going to be. And not only are they already dealing with an issue on the wing with Dunleavy, but you can't, to me, if you think Derrick Rose is going to play more than like 60, 65 games, I think that's just hopeful. It's more optimistic than realistic.
And their backup point guard situation is bad.
Exactly. So I think that they will, what I predict with them is that they will be the team that we're all talking about as the Cavs threatener, but that they won't be doing it from the number one seed.
Yeah, I could certainly see that. And, you know, they do have the ability to still throw out what could be an awesome defensive lineup with Rose, Tony Snell, Butler, Gibson, and Noah. And maybe that's something that we'll see some time to close games if the defense ends up being a major problem. They still, at least they're not going to play Noah and Gasol together. They did that in one preseason game, and it was terrible. And I think the reports over the summer had indicated that Hoiberg was going to go away from that. He tried it. It was terrible. Maybe he'll be forced to give it another try. Noah is coming off the bench right now. I still think that Noah should be starting and Gasol should be coming off the bench, but so be it. We'll see what those combinations end up being. I'd feel a little bit better about them if it were the combination that I liked, but at least it's not Noah and Gasol, which is by far the worst of all of the possible permutations there.
Do you want to give your bottom five of the East playoffs?
Yeah. I guess I was going to say one more thing about Chicago. For everyone who is super high on Bobby Portis, and he's looked really good shooting the ball and with his energy, I don't think he's ready defensively. And so, I mean, you know, expecting him, I'm sure he'll get time with some of those guys being injured, but expecting him to be, you know, a playoff rotation guy for more than about 5-10 minutes a game by the end of the year, he's got a long way to go defensively. So I would slow down on that a little bit, although I do think he has a bright future. All right, so I have number five, Toronto, number six, Boston, number seven, Miami, and number eight, Indy.
Interesting. We'll talk about Indy in a second, but I have five Miami, six Boston, seven Toronto, and eight the Detroit Pistons.
Yeah, that's Detroit was my number nine. Any reactions to what I said? I mean, I'd imagine that Miami at seven might be a little bit lower than most people would think.
I mean, I think if you're going in terms of expected value, that's certainly fair, because the odds that Miami, you know, has their guys on the floor, I mean, it's pretty much already known that Wade's going to miss time. I mean, that's just the way that his body is now. I just think that they have enough talent, and I think that their overall group fits together well enough that they'll be able to withstand that better than they did last year. I like their team a lot.
What is this team going to be good at to you, Miami?
I think that they'll be good at stretching the floor. I think they'll move the ball relatively well.
Wait, stretching the floor. Who's going to stretch the
floor?
When
they're not with their starting lineup, but when I think there's a lineup in place with Gerald Green and with Bosch at the five that they're going to start doing. That's going to actually be their, not their best five, but be the lineup they use a lot. McRoberts, Bosch, Dragic. Gerald Green and whoever they want to play at the three.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a decent point there. Believe me, I am well aware that they could do a lot better. They could be the two seed, the three seed very easily. I worry about injuries with them. I worry about the individual players, so they have a lot of talent, kind of taking a step back and declining a little bit. Whiteside is very unreliable, and if he's not in there, not playing well, it's hard for me to see how they get to be a great defense. I worry about the lack of shooting in the starting lineup, and a lot of guys who really need the ball in their hands operate most effectively that way. So yeah, I don't know. I haven't really liked what I've seen from their starting lineup in the preseason either, although Whiteside missed a lot of time. So yeah, they kind of got to prove to me. Boston, I think, as they've been talked about a lot, the projection systems really like them. They have a lot of guys with high plus-minus metrics, and they just have a lot of decent NBA players, and that is great over the course of the regular season and not be playing anyone who's bad.
They're also well-coached, which I think matters and is a part of this. But yeah, what's so weird about them, I talked about this with Seth Partnow, who's been on both of our shows, about the challenge that I have with them is they did really well with a largely similar lineup, I would say with a weaker lineup than they did in the second half after the deadline last year. So you can think about that two ways. One way to think about that is, hey, they did well with this lineup, they should do well again. The other way was, if that was the aberration, then they could struggle.
Yeah, but you know, you could just as easily say they could do better. There could be an aberration in, or you know, there could be variation upside from there. Probably not, but yeah, I mean, I think that's probably the way they played. You know, winning over 60% of their games after the trade deadline last year is probably the best that you could hope for by far over a full season from this team. I also am making a little bit of a bet on Marcus Smart being a lot better this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Avery Bradley can get a lot better as well. That's another. They just have enough young guys that I think some of them are going to hit. And then the guys who don't hit, they can just not play them as much. So that's another reason why I think I could be high on them.
Oh,
what about Toronto at five? You think that's crazy? That's kind of the one I don't feel as good about.
I don't think it's crazy. I'm not as high on them as you are. I have them seven. But I think that what I'm worried about with them is that while I like the idea of Damari Carroll playing some power forward, is that they just don't have the guys to make that happen. It's the same issue I have with Paul George at power forward, which is if you're going to do that, you need to have the right twos and threes, and I don't think they have enough of them. They have some. They can do that lineup for stretches with presumably with DeRozan and Ross, but beyond that, this is not a team that has depth at swingman spots.
Hmm. Well, I think they don't have a ton of big man depth either, necessarily. Let's talk about Indiana, though. I agree. Toronto is probably the one that I feel the least good about. Atlanta, I don't see them really breaking more than like the very low 50s in wins. I think just everyone's going to take a step back. A lot of the projections don't like them that much. I worry about the health, although Korver has looked okay, and even Cephalosha has looked okay in the preseason, as has Bazemore. Maybe he can take some of those wing minutes.
Who's reportedly starting at small forward to start the year.
Right. Yeah. So that's and Splitter, I think, helps them. They could conceivably be about as good as they were defensively last year. I expect to step back offensively. We'll see, though. But I don't think that they have a ton of upside beyond that low 50s range, and that they could evenly be low 40s. And then Indiana. You don't seem as high on them as I am. When we did our over-under podcast, low those many months ago, when they first came out at the end of September, we both went under on what was like 42 or something for Indiana. My thinking was I need to see it to believe it with Paul George. I don't want to go too crazy on preseason stuff, but he looks like he's pretty much back. So if he is really back, I like playing him at the four because he's just going to be guarding, in most cases, the best wing scorer on the other team anyway. And I do think that you said that they don't have the wing depth. I think they have a lot more wing depth than they have big depth. They have no bigs, so they might as well. I mean, you've got guys like Budinger and Hill are like okay guys. They got Rodney Stuckey. CJ Miles has become a very underrated shooter. So having, if you're the other side, forcing a big man to either guard CJ Miles or guard Paul George, I think is a very difficult assignment for pretty much any big guy. And I think George Hill he probably won't play quite as well as he did last year on a per play basis, but I think he can still be a pretty dynamic player. And Ellis still has a little bit of something left. I think he'll be worth his contract at least this year, if not in future years of that deal. So I think they can get there. And also I believe in Frank Vogel. I think he can cobble together at least an average defense out of this group, despite the fact they don't have a ton of talent outside of maybe, well, I guess the three of their starting five is pretty good, right? Mahinmi, George,
and
Hill, and George Hill, yeah.
Here's my question that gives me all the fear about Indiana. When they, I'll use Miami because they're in the same conference. When they face Miami, who does Paul George guard?
You probably guard Bosch. Bosch isn't going to beat him up.
But I just feel like if that's the way that they're making the decisions, if that's what they're going to do, so when they're facing the Hawks, if he's guarding Horford, if they're, you know, or not Horford, if he's guarding Millsap, you know, if they're going that way more often than not, I feel like that's just going to take a lot out of him.
Well, yeah, I don't know. He has carped about that a little bit. And maybe they'll go back to more traditional big lineups against teams like that where it would make more sense, where George would have to guard the power forward, where that would make more sense. Maybe they would start, and then, you know, he would just guard that guy the last 5 minutes of the game or something. So that's a possibility. I don't think there are that many teams in the East where you're like, oh, man, Paul George is going to get bludgeoned posting up or even on the offensive glass.
Yeah.
If they play Cleveland, he's clearly going to guard LeBron, right? So
also, if George Hill misses time, what happens to this team?
Yeah, then it's going to be Joseph Young, it'll be Stuckey and Ellis. I mean, you know, they'll have enough guys who can create, just those guys are not kind of traditional point guard types. But, you know, I don't think George Hill is that much different from a traditional point guard standpoint than Ellis or Stuckey is. You know, he's not some unbelievable pick-and-roll maestro.
Oh, yeah,
setting up others.
My issue with them is not in terms of, I do like George Hill, and he played very well towards the end of last year. I feel like they didn't build a roster that really can withstand any injuries to their best guys. And considering the odds are that somebody will get hurt, I see them as being less resilient than, let's say, Milwaukee. I think Milwaukee can handle that much better.
I think they can handle an injury to pretty much anyone but George. And maybe Mahinmi would be the other guy if Turner isn't quite ready yet. Although I think he's going to be pretty effective for a rookie, but he's still a rookie, and he's a pretty young one. So here's something to talk about. Neither of us have Milwaukee in the playoffs.
Right? Yeah, that was in my little prediction thing at the end. I think Milwaukee, they're in this spot where I have them ninth, but I would say that they're probably, you know, assuming at least one of those teams is going to fall out, I think they're the team that can jump into that. But they were a team that was distinctly not great after they traded Brandon Knight. And some of that is because Michael Carter-Williams was just not that guy, and some of it, you know, was maybe...
Well, you know, actually, Zach Lowe pointed this out, and it was something I didn't realize, that when he was on the floor after the trade, they were actually, like, they're actually in the green. I think they're, like, plus 2 points per 100 possessions.
Yeah, but if you're a playoff, team, your starting lineup better be in the green. I mean, that's the way that it is. If their starting lineup was not in the green, considering how horrendous the East was last year, what would that say? Like, the Pistons' starting lineup was probably in the green after the deadline.
Yeah, maybe that's true, but you know, you're still going up against other starters, too. So I don't know that there's necessarily a reason to think that your starting lineup should necessarily be that much better than other lineups. Some teams are like that, some teams aren't. But I think for Milwaukee, one of the big reasons they regressed was because Jared Dudley was struggling with that back injury. He was terrible. Guys like Jared Bayless and O.J. Mayo were way over their heads in the first part of the year when they would actually close games with that second unit a lot of times and quite successfully. So that might be a big reason they took a step back as well. If Jabari weren't coming off an injury and were actually going to be ready to start the year and was looking pretty good, I'd feel better about picking them for the playoffs if I had some confidence that either he or Giannis could make a three, which we haven't seen yet at all, then I might feel better about it as well. So, yeah, I think that just, you know, I like where they're still going as a franchise. I'm just worried that they're going to be a little bit less than some of their parts offensively and that they have a lot of young guys who have talent, but sometimes that doesn't all equate into actually being efficient offensively.
I think Jason Kidd has done a very good job both places he's been, and I don't like kind of picking against him in that sense. But I just right now I want to see it before I believe it with them. And as soon as they do it, I'll be on board. You know, they're not a team where it's going to take a lot to convince me necessarily. But we haven't, as you said, with Giannis and Jabari, we haven't seen it. So I can't pick them at this point.
I had Detroit at number 9, you Detroit at number 8. I understand why you're a little bit more down on Milwaukee and Indy. Why are you high on Detroit?
I think that they have that they finally have a team that can do what Stan Van wants to do. I think he's one of the best coaches in the league. It's a lot like how, for me, I had trouble picking against Dallas because of Rick Carlisle. It parallels that. Also, they have Reggie Jackson, who I think will help kind of keep their offense humming well enough, and I think their defense will be fine. You know, they won't be wonderful. And they are a team that I think is a little bit different than some of these, that I think they will improve over the course of the season. You and I are both discouraged that Stanley Johnson doesn't look like he's going to start. I think he will be starting by the end of the year. And so I think that they will be humming better at that point. And I always like that when I'm thinking about a team potentially being a playoff team. I like to think of somebody who I'm like, oh, they're pretty good now, but they can be better later.
Yeah, I think I would like it most if they started Marcus at the four and Johnson at the three. But we'll see what ends up happening. It sounds like it's going to be Marcus at the three and Ilyasova at the four right now. This team, Detroit, would you agree with me that they don't have as much overall talent as either Indy, assuming Paul George is totally healthy, or Milwaukee?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair in terms of aggregate talent. I think that, especially considering Milwaukee, you know, Milwaukee has guys like John Henson, who I think will be a nice little depth piece for them, and they have Grievous Vasquez. You know, I feel that Milwaukee's rotation is a little bit more solid. But also, you're right. I mean, the way that you would have to argue it for Detroit is that Drummond takes a leap, which he could. You know, that Drummond could do that.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm counting on a little bit, yeah.
But I see, for me, one of the things I think about, it's very non-analytical in that sense, is how are they going to beat people, and how, like, when you're facing them on the back end of a back-to-back, are they going to give you extra trouble? And I see them as being a team that's going to win games maybe that they shouldn't. And it's weird to say that. I try to be analytical, but I think that I can see it with them, just like I saw it with Boston the second half of last season.
You know, the one thing I worry about with them is before Jennings comes back, they may have a hole at backup point guard. I think that Baines, despite the fact that he was kind of signed to a premium contract as a backup center, as backup centers goes, he's making a lot of money. I think he's kind of a replacement level guy, frankly, and is older than you think. I think he's 29. So, and I think he also even had surgery in the offseason as well on like his ankle or something. So I don't see, and Drummond is not, he's, centers just don't play that many minutes, so they're going to need a real backup center. I think that area could be a little bit of a sinkhole for them, especially defensively. I think, you know, Baines doesn't bring that much other than just on the boards and, you know, reasonably efficient scorer, but not going to create his own offense. So that's a concern for them. But yeah, I tend to agree that I think they're just the system, the fit, that's something that could triumph for them. And I don't see them making the playoffs. Despite the fact I had Milwaukee lower than them, I think I would give Milwaukee a greater chance of making it than Detroit. But I think, you know, Detroit is probably, you know, 39 and 43, 38 and 44, you know, something like that. Ultimately, I've really liked what I've seen from them in the preseason. All right, so Charlotte, New York, Orlando, Brooklyn, Philly. Actually, I mean, I think Charlotte, we would agree, is probably the best of those remaining teams.
Yep.
What do you think the chances are Charlotte makes the playoffs?
20%, 25%.
How much of this whole they're shooting threes now in the preseason thing are you kind of pricing into their performance this year? Are you buying that, or are you kind of thinking it's going to just be same old Hornets?
I'm pricing it in a little bit. I mean, they have better personnel to do it than they did last year, at the very least. And what's hard for me to reconcile with them is that Steve Clifford has done a really nice job building defenses with them, but their power forwards, generally speaking, are not the kind of defensively capable people that you would think about with that. So,
I think Zeller's okay, but I agree with you on the rest.
Yeah, and when you're playing and they don't have Biombo, you know, they don't really have that kind of guy.
Al Jefferson at center, it's certainly a concern. They don't really have much in the way of defensive talent on that team.
Yeah, and they also don't have, I mean, they're two guard, depending on how you classify their players, is another major problem area, as we talked about earlier in this podcast, with PJ Harrison starting their season opener.
Yeah, that's a concern too. I think they could certainly be better offensively, but they still don't have anyone that you really look at as a dynamic creator. You know, maybe you could look at Jefferson, maybe you could look at Walker. Jeremy Lin has played well in the preseason, but too, so you can hope maybe they kind of get that going by committee. I don't know. I want to like them. I really enjoy what they've been doing from a philosophical standpoint, in the same manner as with Washington. But, yeah, I don't know. I think probably 20-30% is right, just because they've been so good comparatively with MKG on the floor and with him out for the year. It's just it's hard to see how they get there defensively. I mean, I think, you know, they could get into, like, maybe, you know, 13th in offense or something, but I don't see how they get above the median defensively. I think this is probably, you know, the 18th, 19th, 20th best defense, something like that.
Instead of going through ranking for the bottom four teams in the East, what I want to say, ask is, do you see a realistic path for any of these four to make the playoffs?
Oh, so we're talking about the Knicks, Orlando, Brooklyn, and Philly. I would say no. Maybe you could say Orlando, because they do have some talent. If Skiles can just cause a complete defensive revolution there, you know, or maybe if he just kind of starts minimizing Vucevic's role a little bit more, or just gets him to defend it at a completely different level, it gets guys like Harris and Gordon to buy in. I'm not as high on Orlando as some people. I think like their over-under has crept up to like 34, 35. That seems way too high to me. I still expect them to win under 30 this year. But maybe you could say that's the most compelling rationale for any of those teams. I think the Knicks don't have any depth. Brooklyn doesn't have any depth. Philly, obviously, you know, they're going to be mired in the 20-win range, probably below there. So, yeah, I think Orlando is the best one, but I don't particularly like the chances of any of those four teams to even exceed 35 wins, much less be in the playoffs.
I'm with you. I would say the team that has the best chance for me is Brooklyn, just because I think Lopez can carry them a little bit, and they have enough guys that can have a good season. Thaddeus Young is another good example of this. Robinson. I think they have enough guys. Their guard depth is terrifying, absolutely terrifying. But I could, if I found out they, you know, scratched and clawed to the 7 or 8 seed, I would be less surprised than with Orlando.
Yeah, maybe that's true. I'm really just.
But I have Brooklyn. You know, I have Brooklyn 14th, yeah. So I have them. I have them two spots below Orlando. But I just think that I think their rationale. I think their variance is just higher.
Yeah. What about the Knicks? I mean, what if Carmelo? Everyone's saying, all right, Carmelo looks like he's back in the preseason. I still haven't seen him have an efficient game from the hitting threes, getting to the line, getting to the basket in the way that I want. It's been a lot of contested long twos for him, and that I think he shot 4 of 18 and one of those last couple of preseason games, and I think that, you know, he can heat up. But I think kind of the problem when you're relying on the mid-range is that your good games, you know, maybe you'll hit like 55% if you really get hot, but then your bad games, if you're shooting all contested long twos, can be like a 4 of 18 total clunker because you don't have a way to supplement your scoring efficiently on those days when you're not hitting your shot. So that's what I kind of worry about with him. We'll see. You know, it was a major knee operation. He's 31. I still think he's going to be a very good player, but I'm not sure he's quite going to be the transcendent top 10 offensive player that he was before the injury.
The way that I phrase that is that I don't think there's anybody on this team that can be the linchpin of a regularly successful offense. I think that Melo can do it for stretches, not only because he won't be on the floor for stretches, but also just because the way he plays is not necessarily conducive to, you know, an offense humming in that sense. He's a very good player. He's one of those, you know, as you said, he's been a top 10 individual offensive player, but I don't see that with them. And the bigger structural issue is you can have that, but you need to have a reliable defense, and they really, really won't. And so I think that they have more talent than they did last year, but you also have to keep in mind that a team improving from, I believe they won 17 last year, and yeah, some of that was injuries, but they played a lot of non-NBA guys, and they did get better, but they didn't add depth everywhere. They added depth very unevenly, and so I think that they're going to be in that boat where they'll have those moments, but I just don't think there's enough for them to, you know, if they're going into Detroit, I just don't, you know, they're going to struggle. They're going to have teams like that, you know, I think they're going to struggle with average Eastern Conference teams on most nights, and it's hard to be competitive when you're not really racking up any sort of easy wins anywhere.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, so we both put together some off-the-wall kind of predictions. I mean, not necessarily off-the-wall in that they're crazy, but just kind of things that we thought about. Yes, Zach Lowe, we are ripping you off. I'm sorry about that.
It's done out of respect.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're basically ripping off both Simmons and Grantland. So at least our predictions will be different. All right, you want to go first? Give me one.
Sure. I think both New York teams are going to give away top five picks.
Oh, man. Wow, what a disaster that would
be.
And
so technically that could be that New York is swapping it because there's a swap with Denver, but actually then they're giving it away anyway. So yeah, both teams are giving away top five picks.
Yeah, maybe New York could do it twice, right? First they swap with Denver their own top five pick, and then they give away Denver's top five.
Yeah, I should have said New York as a city gives away two top five picks, and then it could have been accurate even if Brooklyn does better.
All right, here's one for me. I think that Washington is the only team in the East that will finish in the top five in defensive efficiency this year. We talked about it when we were going through the Defensive Player of the Year candidates. We named like 12 names, and 11 of them were in the West or something like that. I mean, you know, is it going to Cleveland, Chicago, Atlanta? Maybe Atlanta is the only other one that could get there. Toronto, Boston, Miami, Indy, Detroit, I guess Milwaukee would be the other one that maybe you could look at as being top five. But I think with Parker and Monroe in the front court, they may take a little bit of a step back this year. So, yeah, it's really hard. That, to me, is the biggest difference between the East and the West right now, is just the West is just so much better at defense.
And are there any players, like, you know, you think about kind of who's going to be on the veteran cut line, you know, the waiver wire. I can't think of anybody offhand who can be that real changer on the defensive end, even for 15, 20 minutes a game.
All right, I got another one for you. The eighth seed in the East wins 41 games or more.
I like it. I do. I think that if they stay relatively healthy, I had Milwaukee ninth. I think Milwaukee could definitely finish over 500.
Yeah, I think there's really of those 10 teams in the East, I think that those are all very solid threats to finish at 500 or over. Maybe I'm giving Detroit a little bit too much credit among there, but we'll see. And maybe I'm giving Indy too much credit too. I've just been so buoyed by what Paul George has done in the preseason. Maybe that'll end up and just believing in Vogel's defensive coaching. All right, you got one?
Philadelphia wins 20 or more games.
20 or more games?
20 or more.
All right, I was going to say that one of my predictions would be they're the only team that wins less than 20. What's your thinking?
I think someone's going to lose less than 20, but I think their talent is better this year.
Win less than 20.
Yeah, someone will win less than 20, but I think that the law of large numbers is on the collective is there, but I think that their talent is better this year. I think Brett Brown is going to have them playing better. I also think they're going to play a little bit slower, so that'll give them more of a chance because, you know, when you're under-talented like this team is, if you play fast, you're going to lose more. But I think that they're seeing it a little bit more, and I like Covington. I like Okafor, Noel. I feel like they're getting closer to it, and they want to start building it so that next year I think is going to be the jump through. And if you do that losing 15 to 17 again, I just think that you're starting to make it too easy for people to say you're in a pit.
Yeah, I don't think that they're going to like not try or something. I just think that they can take a little bit of a step back defensively this year with Okafor. I don't know if Covington's shooting is necessarily going to hold up. Isaiah Cain is another guy who shot great on threes last year, might go a little bit down. Nick Stauskas, if he plays a lot, that's going to hurt their defense quite a bit as well, though it might help the offense a little bit with the shooting. So I don't know. I just don't have the feel of a team that's going to win more than 20 games to me, but we'll see what happens. I already said my Cavs don't get the number one seed in the East. And then Chicago does not have a top 10 defense was my other.
Okay, mine is Cleveland loses four or less games in the Eastern Conference playoffs.
What'd they lose last
year?
Two. Four or less games. I mean, that's probably, I don't know that that's really that bold of a prediction. I would say that's probably about what the median for a conference champion
is. I thought this was off the wall, not bold, but anyway, that's a semantic argument.
Not my fault, but yeah, it's,
but that's just not yeah, many, that's I mean, not I think many that's games just, to lose. I mean, that means if you go to a seven game series with anybody else, you need to sweep the other two teams. Not that they're going to go to a seven.
Oh, less than four games, not four or less.
I said four or less. I could, fine, if you want to push me, I'll say less than four.
Yeah, that's okay. That so that's basically you're winning 4-1 every series. Yeah, all right. That's all right. That now qualifies as off the wall.
Yay.
Or something. We don't even know what that means, but all right. Let's probably wrap this up there. Do you have any one of the other? Oh yeah, there's another one you have that I think will be a good one.
Oh, I think that Chicago, not that they are going to do it now, but I think they're going to trade at least one of their big men. And what I'm counting those as is Gasol, Taj Gibson, or Joakim Noah.
I think that's unlikely. In the case of Noah or Gasol, they basically have to trade them to another contender, right? So what are they going to trade for, a wing?
Yeah, or another point guard.
I can't, well, so they're not going to trade one of those guys for a backup point guard, right? Unless Rose is just totally done. I mean, maybe if he is going to miss a ton of the year or something, then maybe I could see them doing that. But with those guys being on expiring contracts, they're of no use to a team that is out of it. And I think teams that are in it aren't necessarily going to want to trade a wing, which is where they really, I think, are going to need help, especially if Dunleavy can't come back and McDermott and Snell can't give them what they hope. I think they end up keeping all those guys because they're all just so injury prone that while it seems like they have a lot of depth, I mean, if you look at really throughout the course of last year, the guys that they had available on the vast majority of nights, one of the four big guys was out. So I think they probably end up keeping all those guys, but I see why you think that that's going to happen. I think, you know, maybe who is the most likely of those three to get traded in your view?
Powell. Because I think that Taj, his fact that he has a longer contract means that you'd be taking such a big leap of faith. And Powell isn't a part of the DNA in the same way that Noah was. I think that would be hard for them to do. And also, I wouldn't be surprised at all. He's a guy who already left a situation to go to the Bulls, that they don't have confidence that he's going to stay after the season regardless. So if you think he's going to leave and you think that he's not, you know, a pivotal part of your team and somebody makes an offer, let's say, I don't think it's necessarily going to be the Thunder, but like a team, let's say in that realm, makes you an offer, then you have to consider it. I mean, because I think he's the type of player that you, if you're a really good team, you give up an asset for him.
You know what I just thought about with him is they're going to be limited in how much they can pay him.
Right.
It's going to be the early bird exception. If they want to keep him and Noah, that means they're going to stay over the cap and, you know, they'll only be able to pay him. Well, you know what? No, it'll probably be okay. 175% of his prior salary. He's making like $7.5 million. So, yeah, I mean, probably low, you know, $12 million or so, whatever that is, 175% of $7.5 million. That'll probably
be. But do you think he'd want to stay in a rotation that includes Gasol and Noah and Mirotić as well?
Maybe not. Although I think he likes Mirotić, but yeah, you would have to imagine that one of Gasol and Noah will not return
right
next year. But that's next year. I think, and Taj, you can't trade him because what if you lose
exactly
Noah or Gasol or both? Then you still really need him, and he's on a value contract. He's looked great in the preseason. He had, you know, he didn't play a ton, but he had, like, you know, a really nice PR in the preseason. So I don't know.
He'd be awesome so many places, though. Like, Taj is a guy, I don't know if you're like this too, but considering your background, that you keep on, like, you go, oh, he would make sense with blank team, or oh, he would make sense with blank.
Because so many any of these teams that has kind of a bad defensive center, you know, like he would be great in like Brooklyn with Brook Lopez, or Orlando with Vucevic,
or Indiana with Miles Turner.
Yeah, that wouldn't be bad either. I mean, there are not, if you really think about it, there are not that many very good defensive power forwards. Now Taj is 30 already because he came into the league when he was 24, so that should be considered as well. But yeah, I mean, he is a very versatile player who fits in a lot of places. All right, let's wrap it up here. You got anything to plug?
We have something to plug, Nate.
Yes. Our AMA on Reddit tomorrow.
Yeah.
Huh?
So,
all right, yeah. What time is that? 10 Pacific?
10 Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern.
All right, yeah, that's going to be awesome. I can't wait to do that.
And then, you know, I think we each have a lot of podcasts that we've done recently. I did over-unders with Arturo Galletti. I did the Pacific Division with Baxter Holmes of ESPN, and I did a season preview with Seth Partnow of Nylon Calculus and seemingly everywhere else, including your colleague at the Cauldron.
That's right. Yeah. 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 So for me, I wrote a piece over the weekend on the Warriors extension candidates, Barnes and Azili, talking about the opportunity cost for the Warriors and that 2017 is really what they're going to be looking at and coming up with also some projected extensions for them and my thoughts on whether it's either going to happen or not. And then I also looked at the best free agent destinations in 2016. If you are just free agent X, where are you most going to want to go for the Cauldron last week? So that's something to check out as well. All right, Danny, thanks so much for coming on, man. It was great having you. And also, make sure to tune in tomorrow night. We're going to actually wrap up some real basketball games and stop talking preview and stop speculating, which is going to be fantastic. You can say goodbye now, by the way. That's where I was going with that. We have no chemistry anymore. This is terrible.
No, but you always end it. I've never ended a single podcast.
I was going to wait for you to say goodbye, and then I was going to say, all right, you know, whatever it is I say, we'll
talk to you later. You don't have a tagline.
All right. We'll talk to you all later.
Bye.